You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Minutes after 8 o'clock here on a Monday morning on the west coast of the United States. I'm joined right now by Matt Morgan. Matt, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Mac. I'm good.
First of all, before we talk about Crossroads, let me give you a chance to comment. National top of the fold news from the Marine Corps, a story that broke on Saturday and percolated over the weekend. The Marine Corps actually reacted on Sunday, which you don't see very often. So let me ask you to react to it in two different ways. One as a Marine and two as a public affairs guy. So as a Marine, react to it.
You know, I've seen this type of thing happen, of course, over the course of my career in one form or another. And I look back at, you know, being a young infantry officer, the kind of jackassery that my Marines would typically engage in. You know, and now we are in a different world. You know, I didn't live with social media when I was a platoon commander. And now we've got this situation where the Marines are living essentially in a glass barracks where their behavior can be broadcast to the entire world, and they can also build whole communities around it. So it's not just a couple of, you know, jackasses in your platoon. You know, they can build a following of, you know, upwards of 30,000 individuals who may or may not even be Marines. So that part of it's unfortunate. I think from a public affairs perspective, you know, the Marine Corps is doing everything right at this point in getting out ahead of this. It's always very, very difficult when you're a BAO and you're going into counsel a senior leader on getting in front of something. These days, though, I will say that most Marine leaders have been conditioned to the point now that they understand the imperative of getting this stuff out in the open as quickly as possible. So they're doing that at this point, and that part of it is sound. So they're just going to have to roll with the punches for the next couple days.
How do you make, I guess you don't make this go away. How do you deal with it? The Marine Corps, I think, has a history of walking someplace and taking a face shot. Is that the best to do? Is it to accept responsibility, take your face shot, and then go fix it? Is that as good as it gets in these situations?
Absolutely. I mean, you really don't have any other options. You could take a strategy that I've seen the Army take in a few cases, which is to, you know, try to suppress this, and it never goes well, because then the suppression effort becomes a leading element of the story. You know, so the Marine Corps has to be responsible and take the face shot. That's the only way you can manage this. It's just like being a leader. You have to address the issue. You can't run from it.
All right. One final question for you, and that is the last email I got here in the last segment was, hey, Mac, you are not going to stop young people from being young people. You kind of alluded to it when you said, hey, you know, I never lived in a world where the jackassery that went on in my platoon might wind up on the NBC Nightly News, because it could have been broadcasted all over the world. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, Mac, when we were platoon commanders, we didn't have to deal with the fact that there was, you know, over-the-counter technology that could jam our GPS systems, because we didn't have GPS systems. We were using maps and compasses. You know, you adapt to the world you live in. No, you can't expect young people not to engage in some questionable activity like this, but you can't expect Marines to live to a higher standard. And I think that's one of the big points that the Commandant has made, which is these individuals who are exploited or are the victims of this are fellow Marines, and they deserve better than that.
All right, let's we'll change gears now. Talk to me about the concept of Crossroads. How long have you had it in your head, and where did it come from?
The idea started back in 2013. There was an article that came out, actually as an opinion piece in the Washington Post. It came out 7 days before I was retired. And it was written by Sebastian Younger. And he made the point that he's made consistently since then through both, you know, his books and Vanity Fair pieces that he's written on the subject, is that combat veterans need the opportunity to share the moral burden of war. And he initially called for this notion of, you know, a day of sharing where you'd have your veterans, you know, share their experiences in front of large groups of people and Americans having the opportunity to share in that experience. And I thought, well, that was a noble idea. I didn't think it was practical, because we know that combat veterans generally talk with other combat veterans, but aside from telling a couple funny stories, they don't really share the things about their experience that changed them, that really transformed them, both the good and the bad. They don't open up in a way that is meaningful to someone who can't relate to their experience. So it occurred to me that if I could sit down and have a one-on-one conversation with a combat veteran, where my experience informed the questions that I asked, that we might be able to create an opportunity for others to eavesdrop on this experience. And the only downside, I think, that of what we're doing here right now is exactly the point that Sebastian made to you on this program, which is, you know, a lot of the people that are listening right now are combat veterans. They can relate to this experience, but it's my hope that those veterans who listen to this will see themselves reflected in the veterans of different eras, or of their own, and the relationship, the bond, the unique bond that combat veterans of different wars do share, and then we'll take the opportunity to share those conversations a little more broadly through your podcasts.
All right. Talk to me about, introduce today's, the subject of today's episode.
I started close to home, since this was kind of a little pilot project initially, and so I sat down and talked to my father-in-law. You know, you've talked to Angie on the show before, and I don't know if you guys have ever gotten into the fact, but a lot of what pushed Angie toward the Marine Corps was the fact that her father had himself been a Marine. He was enlisted in 1963 and had a really interesting experience with regard to joining the Marine Corps actually before we were really involved in Vietnam, and then being a part of the expanding war in 1965 and 66. So his experience is pretty unique. One of the things that I discovered too is that we tend to look at the experiences of individual veterans in a given time period to be very similar. And what I discovered between interviewing Jerry Judge, who was a Marine in Vietnam in 1965 and 66, his experience was very different from that of a sergeant who was in Vietnam in 1967 and 68. So we look at these experiences being homogenous, but they're not. Everybody's experience is different, and that's one of the things that I always take away from listening to your program and the combat veterans that talk here, is that there is no single unifying experience. There is a lot of diversity in what we take away from war. And I think that by sitting down with my father-in-law, you know, I had the opportunity to learn things about him that I never knew. And when we were done, he actually called me and, you know, about a day later and said, you know, I've never talked about my experience in the Marine Corps from beginning to end. You know, just described why I joined, where I went, what I did, and what it was like to leave. And he found that experience to be really rewarding.
All right, so we're going to meet Jerry Judge right here, yes?
This is Jerry.
This is, you know what? On that, you're going to meet Jerry Judge. And, Matt, we'll go ahead and I think you have to mute your mic on your end, and we'll go ahead and roll this. A little bit of on-air production here, and there's three segments to it, and it's I had a chance to listen to it a couple of times, and you know what, it's what I love about it is he could come from any community in this country, he could be any man or woman in this country, and his experience is so typical in terms of what people go through when they go to war. And not knowing what to expect, and Matt does a great job in terms of just a conversation with him, and things that moved him, things that made him a different person. So, with that said, this is Jerry Judge.
For most of his adult life, Jerry Judge has been a teacher, and in the small town of Kalkaska, Michigan, most of the residents remember him as Mr. Judge, the old high school principal. Some of his former students might even recall that hanging behind his office desk, he had a poster of John Wayne in the movie The Sands of Iwo Jima. Printed across the bottom of the image of the Duke as Marine Corps Sergeant John Stryker was a simple sentiment. Life is tough, but it's a lot tougher if you're stupid. The poster was the only thing in that office, other than perhaps Mr. Judge himself, that might have clued a student in on the idea that their principal had once been a Marine. He never really talked about the fact that in 1965, he was not Mr. Judge, but Sergeant Judge, a 19-year-old Marine squad leader fighting in a country he'd never even heard of. I'm Matt Morgan, and this is Crossroads. Two combat vets, one mic, and a few war stories.
I had to do a research paper for a college prep English course, and I did the Battle of Iwo Jima. And I got so enthralled with that, I went down and enlisted on a delay program in April of 1963. Then, like 5 days after graduation, I was in San Diego, California boot camp.
How old were you?
17. I just turned 17 in January.
January of 1965, where were we at?
Okinawa. We had just completed our training. We'd been through counter-guerrilla warfare training, amphibious raider training, and our whole battalion was pretty much on call at that time.
Had you heard of Vietnam?
Never. Just when we got to Okinawa, we heard about something going on over there. But in 63 and 64 in California, I never heard of it. And then they called us out to get on LSTs and shift out to Vietnam. Well, we landed at Da Nang, and we were basically called in to guard the airstrip. The bombing in the north and other was escalating, and they wanted us to guard the airstrip at Da Nang. And getting off that ship, it wasn't a tactical landing. We just got off the ship, and still remember the odor and the heat. And our uniforms at that time were the old sateen type that had been around since probably Korean World War II, and they just weren't made for that area. And it was sweltering hot.
So what was your number one responsibility then? At the time, you're how old?
I was up to about 19 then, and our responsibility then was to guard the airstrip at Da Nang. The French had been there and left some old bunkers, and then we used those and plus other ones, and we were given a sector of the airstrip at Da Nang to guard. And it was kind of different because, you know, we were all gung-ho, and then you said you can't have a round in your chamber, we can't engage unless they engaged first, but it was strictly a defensive situation to guard the airstrip.
How long do you think you were going to be there?
3 to 6 months, and we were a little upset because we got an extra $100 a month combat pay. And when you're only making about $100, that was good money.
So you were with one of the first Marine battalions to land.
Correct.
In Vietnam.
Yep.
And with the 9th Marine Expeditionary Brigade, you're actually the landing directive that was given to the battalions there was that the U.S. Marine Force will not engage in day-to-day actions against the Viet Cong.
Well, it was pretty much during the day. It was, you know, it's sometimes very boring. You're sitting in foxholes, and sometimes you were back and you had a hardback tent. Then at night, you would come up and you would be two to a bunker or whatever, and you'd sleep 2 hours, and the other guy would watch 2 hours. And sometimes we'd walk between the different bunkers, just occasionally, once in a while, you'd hear a sniper round or something. But it was nothing that you ever felt threatened. It was pretty much guard duty until later on, where we did get mortared and they blew up a couple planes.
Tell me about that night.
Well, it was funny because it was one of the last nights I ever slept in Vietnam with my pants off. We were in a hardback tent, which is just a tent that's got wooden structure, and it was a dirt floor, and all of a sudden you hear this boom, this explosions, and small arms fire, and we didn't know what it was. It was our first exposure to Viet Cong fire, so we rolled out of this little cot I had. It was like a camping cot, put on the cartridge belt and rifle and helmet, so I ran out, and we had ditches dug, and I was there in my underwear, a cartridge belt, and helmet and rifle, as with everybody else, too. And we just waited. And you could see thank God they were doing a lot of illumination mortars and everything, so it was all lit up, and we could see across where the planes were burning, but it wasn't where we were guarding. And then I still remember two or three of the Air Force guys who were on that end came running across the field, and they fortunately identified themselves because there was about 150 Marines there ready to shoot them. So that was our first exposure to the Viet Cong.
Yeah, that was actually July 1st. The Marine Corps had increased their presence so that the entirety of the 3rd Marine Division was there. And so you began to see a change in the way you conducted operations.
Right. We started doing patrols. During day times, we'd get out and with the villagers, and we call them candy patrols. We just had to go out and be, you know, show them we were nice guys and everything else. And then at night, you'd do a night patrol, which was kind of like a combination patrol ambush, just kind of extend the perimeter of the defenses around Da Nang. And that was some of our first exposure. It was a little hairy. You're 19 years old. You got a squad, and you're leading these guys out in the middle of nowhere. The maps were not that accurate at that time. We used a lot of aerial photographer, but that's what our mission then was. Gradually, just you could see it escalating, and it still we weren't supposed to engage until we were they engaged on us first.
So you're 19 years old.
Correct.
You're a squad leader. Leading 12 other Marines.
Yeah.
Tell me about your first night patrol.
Well, I never forget because I got back. We had a regular, they give you checkpoints to go on. And I got back and they said it should take this amount of time. And I remember a platoon commander says, you're back awfully quick. We didn't mess around. We knew where we went, where we were supposed to go, but I couldn't see any need to spend an extra hour out there. So it was uneventful, but it was just, you know, it's a little spooky. And you never really get used to going on a night patrol, but if you say you don't have, you're a little nervous about anything, then you're not right. it's, you know, over the next year, several night patrols that, I couldn't remember. I always remember the first one though.
So the situation in Vietnam is changing at this point.
Oh, correct, yeah. And it was different because it's almost like they didn't really want us to engage. And it was so gradual. And gradually, we started doing these search and destroy operations on the villages close around Da Nang that we'd go through and you'd check for weapons. And actually, they'd say, how do you tell a Viet Cong from a regular civilian? They had ID cards. So you check their ID cards, and if they didn't have one, you'd pick them up as a Viet Cong suspect. If they had too much rice, if they weren't allowed to have any weapons, but there were certain things you looked for in those villages to see what was going on. And it was really hard to tell because a Viet Cong, you know, they wore like a black pajamas and a white shirt or whatever, and you couldn't tell. And they could be your friends during the day, and they snipe at you at night.
Tell me about this too much rice.
Well, they weren't allowed to have so much, and if there was too much of it there, like a normal family, and I really can't remember how much, they had like these barrels. If they had excess rice there in bags, you were to confiscate it. And I was born and raised on a farm. I felt a little bad for some of these villagers. Maybe they were just trying to make a profit, but we had to collect the excess food because we figured they could be supplying the Viet Cong. You have to realize that when we're patrol, we had to always expose ourselves first. We would be walking across the rice paddy or something else, and we'd start getting sniped at. And then many times, you just start shooting back in that direction. You didn't know, you didn't see anybody, but you just knew if it was later in the evening, you'd see a rifle flash or whatever, but it was pretty much you were online walking across rice paddies, and you're getting shot at. And unfortunately, they weren't the best shots. It's another thing to note, most of the weapons we captured were American weapons. The ARVN, or the South Vietnamese Army, would desert with their weapons. So M1s, carbines, and other weapons, they were a very, very unreliable military. You know, I think any Vietnam veteran, infantry, would say the same thing. They were very unreliable. Later on, you know, in the 70s, when I heard about Vietnamization, I said, oh, this is done. It's not going to work.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
The Marines in general pride themselves on their marksmanship training, and I know that you actually later became a marksmanship instructor once you returned to the United States. But did you ever at any point, I think in your experience and all the firefights that you had engaged in, felt like you were actually engaging the way that you had been trained to engage?
No. When you're a recruit, you shot at 200, 300, and 500 yards on fixed targets. And you got certain weapons. At that time, we still had M14s. And later on, they got M16s, but you had adjustable sights. Well, you didn't get a chance to lay down and squeeze off a round. You had to, it was pretty much, you're shooting in that direction. And then also, many of us had selector switches. In a Marine Corps squad, there's three fire teams, and each of those fire teams has a leader plus an automatic weapon. And before the M14, they had a Browning automatic weapon. Well, when we came to the M14, that they had a selector switch. Well, over the time, most all of us had selector switches. So many times we were shooting on automatic, and it pretty much limited how much ammunition. There was never a short supply of ammunition, but you could eat it up very quick with an automatic. So we'd be on semi-automatic most of the time.
How did most firefights end at that point?
Everybody just quit shooting. It was done. We were shooting. We didn't hear them anymore. And that was pretty much it. And a lot of it was hit and run, the guerrilla tactics. They would shoot, and we'd shoot back. And pretty soon, they wouldn't be shooting. Somebody, a platoon commander or some squad leader, say cease fire because you're just wasting ammo then.
So you're seeing very, very little of the enemy, right?
No, they weren't standing out there. You look at movies of World War II and Korea, and they got... It was rarely that you ever seen a Viet Cong or later on North Vietnamese soldier. You were just, shooting where the direction the bullets were coming from. Talk about strange things that happened. We were going across this long rice paddy. And if you have to realize the rice paddy is about 3 or 4 inches of mud and water and the rice is growing, and about every so often the dike, about 2 or 3 feet up. I was walking across there, and we started hitting sniper and shooting back and forth, and I dove into behind this dike to get a firing position, and there's a lot of snakes in Vietnam, and the snake crawled across the back of my leg. Well, like anybody else, it startled me, and I jumped up. Well, the corpsman thought I'd been wounded, and he come running up, falls down beside me, and said, "Where you hit?" I said, "It wasn't. It was a snake." And he gave me some expletives about... I wasn't being shot, and he risked his life. And I said, "Oh, well, that's the way it goes." Fortunate for both of us, either of us got shot. Now, it's interesting during the time. I think you always have the feeling that it's never going to be you. And people are cracking jokes in firefights even sometimes about, whatever. I mean, it's just, I don't know if that's a training. It was just, you're always looking for something that's a little peculiar. And when afterwards a firefighter, everybody would kind of sit down. It was like downtime, explain what was going on when this was happening. But most of it, they said daytime, you'd go on these search and destroys. You'd get online, you'd go through a village, you'd search it all out. Then if it was getting close to evening, then you dug a hole, or sometimes there was ditches around there, and two men to a foxhole, and then you would put out flares or trip wires or anything, claymore mines, and then you sit down, and then many a times you would have a night patrol to take out from there. If not, you stayed in your foxhole, and you're up 50%. One guy up, one guy sleeping all night. Then the next day, depending on what you're doing, you usually get up and move out. But that was a long day. I can never say we had a large encounter with an enemy. I mean, we had some, but it wasn't like you see the big battles of World War II in Korea. It was never like that. It was smaller skirmishes. I mean, there were some incidents other Marines got in. We did, but it wasn't, you know, that was rare. It was pretty much, you know, sometime during the day you felt very secure. We sat around sometimes, played cards. It was kind of boring. And then at night, you always kind of dread the night because you're hoping it wasn't your squad that had to do the night patrol. You know, you just couldn't tell what was going to happen. I mean, it wasn't that you weren't afraid of the dark, but you didn't like it being night because you couldn't see that far out there what was going on. And you just the uncertainty of what was going on because you're sitting there all night and you're 2 hours. But it was funny, you're 2 hours, you'd be really alert. Then you're 2 hours asleep, well, you were right to sleep. Then you woke up 2 hours later and just hope the other guy didn't get you up 5 or 10 minutes early before that because you wanted to get your 2 hours in.
Ever have any indicators that it was probably going to be a bad night?
Yeah, one time we had done an operation. We had swept through some villages, and here again we got to the other side, and there's another village. Villages were sometimes far between or very close, and there was a village about 100 yards away. We dug in, and we noticed all the other villagers leaving. So, they got some word we didn't.
Do you remember the first time you took casualties?
Yeah, I remember the guy's name. His name was David Brown. He was on a night patrol. It was the first one, and he is another squad leader, and it was a booby trap. Hit him in the forehead, and we thought he was fine. He came back to where our platoon was located, and they medevaced, or brought him in a helicopter and took him out. And he was talking and everything else. And about a week or so later, we found out he had died. That was our first casualty. And most of the casualties we had were from booby traps, mines, mortars. Very few were bullet wounds.
Because the Viet Cong weren't delivering
accurate fire. A lot of people don't realize, too, you got all those people with hand grenades and weapons. And there's some cases of accidental, death. I mean, that didn't happen to us, but you hear about somebody killed by friendly fire or something that happened. It's going to happen. I mean, when you got that many people, we were, you know, all of us 19, 20 years old. Not when we weren't irresponsible, but the thing's going to happen. You're getting 19, 20-year-olds together on a football field, somebody's going to get hurt.
So at night, you'd dig in, you'd set out your claymores, you'd go to 50% security. But you had one individual who was innovative on your security one night. Tell me about Lizard.
Oh.
We could just go with
Lizard. Oh, sure. I won't tell him his real name, but usually everybody had a nickname. This guy had really, in the sun, and everything was so hot, and his skin was kind of white, and blistered and everything, and we called him Lizard. He looked like a lizard. Well, he got a picture from his girlfriend, and she wasn't the most attractive either. And we got in at night, and his fire team leader said, "Hey, Lizard, can I get a picture of that 8x10 of your girlfriend he was carrying?" He says, "Why?" He says, "I want to put it out there with the trip flares. They see her, they're going to run." We weren't the most sensitive to each other's needs. But that's the kind of thing you did to keep your sanity, I guess.
What were some of the other nicknames in your squad?
Well, one of the guy I was with most time, he had his big chin. We called him Chin. Another guy had his head didn't look like it was proportioned to his body. We called him Head. So everybody, if you had some physical disability, and it was meant in jest. But
not always the most creative.
No, no. No, everybody had most of it just went by last name. They said I was just called Judge. I don't think I had any other names.
Throughout the end of 1965, the situation in Vietnam began to change.
Definitely.
And what you were encountering, the kind of activity you were encountering changed.
Well, we went from running into Viet Cong to the North Vietnamese Army, the regulars. And that's when probably were more casualties and more firefights and more conventional, even though they didn't have tanks and everything else, but they... I can still remember my first hearing of an AK-47 as opposed to the American weapons that the Viet Cong were shooting us with. I think in the Heartbreak Ridge, they said Clint Eastwood says you'd never forget the sound of an AK-47. He's right.
Is that pretty much the only way you knew?
Well, and then some of the casualties, they had uniforms and they had helmets. Viet Cong didn't have any of that. They had regular uniform, and they were you know, large groups of them. But here again, still, you know, you got to hand it to them. They're in an area that's mainly occupied by U.S., and how secretive large groups like those could hide. I mean, you're by jungle and everything, but not knowing, our intelligence didn't always know where they were.
Did the way you engaged the NVA change from what you experienced with VC?
Well, yeah, you would have more sustained firefights. They would stay longer and more firepower, and here again, all of a sudden, it would be gone. And a lot of times, you didn't find this bodies, because a lot of you would find them, and they would have coils of wire around their arms and their legs, because they would have like a hook and pull them away. They took care of their dead and wounded too, I guess, that way. Occasionally, I had a couple places that we had found. I had some pictures of them. You weren't supposed to take those, but it was just the more intense firefights than it had been earlier. From going from a sniper here and there to a regular all-no firefight.
Were you able to engage more directly or accurately?
Yeah, when you were fighting the North Vietnamese Army, you would see shadows and movement at night. Most everything is done at night. So, you know, they always say if the time, you go back to when I was talking about night, the most time you're likely for an attack is just before dark and just before daylight. And that was so true. Rarely in the middle of the night did you ever, I think that attack at Da Nang was like 2-something in the morning, but mainly if you're confronting, it's going to be just before dark. And a lot of time, just before dark is then they could slip away.
So it's now the spring of 1966. Do you remember the day that you left?
Definitely. I was out on a platoon-sized operation. About everything you did was in platoon. Now, if you look at that movie Platoon, that was an Army movie, but that's the size of groups you worked with, was mainly platoon and squad. And we were out in kind of an outpost, and they said, what had happened? I went over with A Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. Then, so that we could get with people just coming over, I took my squad to E Company, and then to F Company, 2-9, 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, so that everybody wouldn't be coming at the same time and going at the same time. And also, we were experienced, and we were kind of training those people about what to look for. And you never knew when you were coming back. And I was out and just came off. I'd been back. It was in the afternoon, and they just said, Judge, your time is up. Helicopter flew in, and I flew back to Da Nang. And it's really interesting, because that's the first time in like a year that I had to turn in my rifle. So it was like a day and a half sitting there on there waiting to get processed to go back to Okinawa that you didn't have a rifle. And that was a very insecure feeling. So what had happened, we came back to Da Nang, and then we flew back to Okinawa where we had left some of our stuff, our equipment, and that was the first time in a year that we went to a barracks and slept in sheets. And then after that, was there a couple days and came back to El Toro Marine Air Station in California. But what had happened, it was like 5 or 6 days from the time you left the battlefield, actually, to you came back to the States, that you had time to kind of calm down. You talked to other people. And later on, you hear about guys getting PTSD. They got on the airplane, flew home, and discharged them. And it probably wasn't intentional, but the way we were getting processed, and we were some of the first to come back. So many of the other sergeants, corporals, whatever, even recruits, they were very interested in what it was like in Vietnam, and they were always asking you questions about it.
When you came back to Okinawa and you were reunited with all your uniforms, did they fit?
No. All of us had lost about 30 pounds, and then what happened, we had reissued some uniforms. Mainly we just wore the work uniform and didn't have too many dress uniforms, but then we got issued. Then about 2 or 3 months later, we're back in the States, and none of them fit. They were too tight. We got that good food back in the mess hall.
Thank you.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Did you ever have, we talked about turning in your rifle, did you ever have dreams, you know, wake up looking for your rifle?
Oh, yeah, that's the biggest thing. My biggest reoccurring, I don't know, dream or nightmare is that he said, I grew up on a farm, and it always was like the Viet Cong were trying to take over our farm or other people's farm. They were closing in, and that was one thing, and you couldn't find your rifle, but you couldn't get that out. Hey, you know what? I can't say nightmares or anything else, but it was scary. You were glad to wake up and find out there wasn't being calm out in the back 40.
You got out of the Marine Corps. You went to Central Michigan to college to do what?
Well, I got in and I went on a GI Bill. That time was a whopping $135 a month. And I went into education. I thought I really wanted to coach. And it's funny because Central Michigan didn't have a lot of protesters. There was a few, but it's almost like you put that all behind you. You didn't talk about it. Sometimes you'd have a class. You had to introduce yourself and give a little of your history. And it wasn't really pro or con the way other people feel about it. I think a lot of them would like to bend their shoes because we had our military obligation done and they were still sweating the draft. But I was like a 21-year-old freshman and they were all 18 years old. And I can't think. And there was also, we had a group of campus veterans that a lot of them hadn't been to Vietnam, but there was somebody that you could hang out with. It wasn't really a fraternity, but we were called the campus vets. And it was basically a lot of time, just if you went to a bar, you knew somebody else. But it was just like, that part of my life was done with. I want to go to college, get done, I want to teach and coach, and that's what I did. And started teaching after I graduated in 71, I started teaching in MESIC.
How long did you teach there?
About 5 years. In the meantime, I got a master's degree in ed administration, and I got a principal's position in Launce in the Upper Peninsula. And I stayed there for 8 years, and then went to Kalkaska for 10 years, and then I went to the last 5 years in Royal Oak. I was high school principal at Dondero High School.
So you went from a 19-year-old Marine sergeant in Vietnam at the outset of the war, and by the time you left, the military infrastructure was in place that would exist there for pretty much the remainder of that war. And you, by the time the United States withdrew, you're now a principal in Lance.
Correct. I can still remember 1975 when the South Vietnamese Army is being overrun by the North Vietnamese. And I thought back, you know, when I was 19, I was in Vietnam. I did 4 years another year or so in the service, 4 years of college, got a master's degree, taught school for 5 years, and I'm a high school principal, and the war was still going on. You know, they talk about involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. That is, you know, that was 10 years that war was going on, that, you know, you feel you participated. Now, and we had the attitude, what we thought at the time, we were doing right. We were very patriotic. And, you know, we didn't know about everything else going on behind the scene. I mean, we were enlisted guys. We were doing our job. But we didn't realize all the political aspects that was going on that you hear about now.
Today, a lot of veterans, you know, whether Marine veterans from Fallujah, Ramadi, or Marine veterans also from Helmand Province, Afghanistan, watch the news and they see that essentially the territory that they had fought so hard for, that they'd seen their buddies die for, has been lost, essentially. How did you feel when you're, you know, a decade later watching U.S. forces pushing helicopters over the side of an aircraft carrier.
Well, I was very disappointed and upset, but then you look at now with our relationship with them, I just hope that the 52,000 guys who were killed wasn't in vain. I hope that, you know, Vietnam's kind of an ally today, and I hope someday we can get that way with Iraq. But, you know, it's just like in Vietnam, sometime you would fight to take over a hill, then you would leave, give it back to them. What are we fighting for if we give it right back to them? I always said if somebody could go to look at Vietnam, how, you know, capitalism has almost taken over, maybe we could do the same thing in Iraq, you know, open a big Walmart, get them jobs. Maybe they wouldn't fight all the time.
When I was on active duty, one Christmas, we bought you a Marine Corps golfing shirt at the Marine Corps Exchange in Norfolk, Virginia. Where was that golfing shirt made?
Vietnam. First thing I noticed. But, you know, it's, I don't know if what our participation there did to, even though it's communism, but it goes back to economics, and, you know, they're one of our trading allies now. But and I don't know, you know, here again, I hate to think that the many of the people I knew that died and the other 50-some thousand, it was in vain.
Listening to Mac Talk on the All Warrior Radio Network. You're listening to All Marine Radio, and just listen to the first installment of Crossroads with Matt Morgan. We're going to take a quick break in this hour of All Marine Radio, brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the Battle Mug, and that you can check out their entire line of products at battlemug.com. It starts with a 10-pound block of aluminum. They mill it, machine it, and then make a quality product for you to customize to make it your very own. Each one is serialized. You can have it engraved. Absolutely beautiful. Battle Mug is a perfect gift for any commemorative event, farewells, promotions, retirements, birthdays, anniversary. Something that if you have a veteran, you have somebody on active duty, and you're looking for a very unique gift, or simply an outdoorsman, or somebody who's just looking for a really cool gift, check out the Battle Mugs. You can do it at battlemug.com. A whole line of products. Use the promo code Marine for 15% off. It's a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely of in the United States. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk to Matt Morgan. I got a couple questions for him here, people that are listening. More of a Monday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Listen up, employers. Veterans can be a great asset to your company or organization. Veterans have gained skills in leadership, teamwork, and performance under pressure. Veterans have received the very best training in their fields and are never afraid to tackle a tough situation to accomplish the mission. If you are looking to hire a veteran, the Department of Labor can help you make it happen. You hire a veteran today, you won't be sorry.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Blaubeltzoff Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Globalsoft website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Globalsoft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Six on a Monday, Mike McNamara with you, and rejoining me is Matt Morgan. Matt, first of all, thank you for allowing us to spend some time with your father-in-law. That was awesome. I loved it.
Great. Glad you enjoyed it.
The what did you find? Did you know just about everything he discussed when you and he sat down?
I'd heard a lot of the war stories, but the whole, you know, front-to-back story was something that was new to me.
What did you find, as he told his story, what did you find most interesting?
You know, as I started really looking at it, I was thinking about the experience that he had very early on in the war and realizing that, you know, he came home, he went to college, he became a teacher, then became principal. I mean, all of this thing, his life went on. He had children, and all of those things happened before the war ended. And so he was able to look back on the war that had begun when he was 19 as a principal who entering his 30s, you know, a man with three children and a job. And so I thought that was really interesting to kind of have that perspective on the war.
Wow. Wow. The certainly interesting. You know, it's one of the things I think that's most interesting about Vietnam is depending on what year you were there, the war was very different. And I guess you could say that for just about for our most recent wars, too. I mean, the war in Iraq is incredibly different in 2003 than it is in 2004. A conventional fight versus a non-conventional fight, and then it changes every year, and it depends, on where you go. But he gives a snapshot of what life was like, largely fighting at first the Viet Cong in and around Da Nang in 1965.
Yeah, it was an interesting example of a mission creep. You know, he goes there to guard an airfield for a few months, and by the time he leaves, they've moved north out of Da Nang, and we're patrolling up around the Phu Bai area. So, that changed dramatically. It made me reflect, of course, on my own experience. You know, when I deployed to Iraq in 2003, I had no children. When I deployed to Iraq in 2007, 2008, I had a two-year-old when I left for that deployment. And now I look at, you know, Marines going back into Iraq, and I've got, you know, a child in middle school, another one in elementary school. You know, I've retired and left the Marine Corps. It's just amazing to kind of look back on that experience, and he had a very similar experience in that regard. And I'll tell you, that's something that we had never really related to each other on.
When you reflect on that, how do you think that would impact you, or how did it impact you, deploying with a two-year-old?
Deploying with a child versus deploying without a child was a dramatically different experience. The only thing I could really be thankful for was that he was only two at the time, and when I came home, he had just turned three, so I missed that year of his life, and we had to reconnect. But that's easier to do with a preschooler. I look at my colleagues, peers, friends who deployed, who had kids who were teenagers, 13, 14-year-old boys, or high school age girls. You know, I have to believe that, you know, and you could probably speak to this, Mac, but I have to believe that's a lot more challenging to maintain those relationships and make up for the time lost.
You know, I felt, for whatever reason, once I had a kid, I felt different. I felt more vulnerable. I thought when I was married, my ex-wife, a good-looking woman, and if something happened to me, she was going to get, you know, $400,000, and she had the rest of her life, and you know, she'd be okay. And but when we had our first son, that wasn't going to be okay with me, right? I was going to, you know, if something happened to me, he'd be without his father. It changed me. I'm curious, did it change you?
Well, it changed the way I approached that second deployment, for sure. We were lucky enough in that respect that not only did I have a wife who'd been with me effectively for years before I deployed the first time, she herself was a Marine, and so she could somewhat relate to the experience. You know, Jerry, he wasn't married when he went to Vietnam. He came home, he met his future wife in college, and to this day, you know, they're in their early 70s now, and to this day, I don't know that my mother-in-law can fully relate to that man, you know, that she met in college, or to understand what his experiences were prior to meeting her.
Interesting. First of all, well done, well done, well done. Who are we going to meet at the crossroads next week?
Next week you'll meet Walt Heller. Walt is, he'll be 94 coming up pretty soon, and Walt was a Marine Raider, served in Guam and Okinawa. So he's a very sharp guy. He's got a great wit about him, and I think that his experience is wonderful. I loved talking to him because he, you know, you ask him how he joined the Marines, and his story is like, I was thinking about joining the Navy, and my buddy said, I'm going to join the Marines, and Walt said, well, hell, I guess I'll join the Marines too. So, you know, it's interesting talking to those guys from that era. And he's going to be interviewed actually by a fellow combat veteran, Iraq veteran named Todd Sanders. Todd retired from the Marine Corps actually the same day I did, 2013. And it's interesting to hear, you know, a combat veteran from the World War II era relate to a combat veteran of the modern era in terms of, you know, fighting at night. Versus, you know, the Japanese proficiency for fighting at night versus the way the Marines kind of handled those nighttime attacks. So it's very interesting in the context of today's fight as well.
All right. Well, first of all, Matt, Awesome segment, and well done, well done. It's a privilege to meet your father-in-law and hear his story here on All Marine Radio. So thank you, and look forward to next Monday.
Thanks, Mac. Carry on.
There you have it. That is Matt Morgan here well done on All Marine Radio. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Gunner's going to join us. So All Marine Radio continues. Crossroads. Awesome. More of that coming up next.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good. Past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
As we recognize the service of America's men and women in uniform, let's also honor the families who sacrifice so much every day. Military families endure frequent deployments and separations. They carry on while their loved ones are sent into harm's way and wait patiently for their safe return. If you really want to honor a veteran, look for ways to support their families and thank them for their sacrifices. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
This is Montel Williams. As a U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran, I know the sacrifice that our servicemen and women make for us every single day. If you're a veteran or a military member transitioning out of the service, help is available to you. The U.S. Department of Labor can help you get training, find a good job, or further your education. Contact the Veterans Employment and Training Service at 866-487-2365 or visit dol.gov/vets.